Today we're going to explore something that we've never really done. A bunch of years ago, we talked about the Arba Parshiyot and the connection with the sequencing of Shkalim and Zachor and then Parah and HaChodesh and how that all builds up towards Pesach. But to look at Parah Adumah itself, specifically in the context of Pesach, is something that I'd like to explore today. Traditionally, why do we understand that let's go through the Arba Parshiyot, that we read the Arba Parshiyot when we do? Because the Arba Parshiyot aren't necessarily a unit. After all, we do skip at least 1 week, and this year 2 weeks, between reading the Parshiyot. Right? We read, skip the second day of Adar, and then the 2 weeks later, the 16th of Adar. So what is up with the Arba Parshiyot? So the first Parshiyot is Shkalim. Why do we read Shkalim when we do? Because we need to get our Machzir HaShekel into the Beit HaMikdash fund by Rosh Chodesh Nisan. It takes a month to get everything changed, and ta-da-ta-da, so the halacha is Rosh Chodesh Adar, we have to publicize it. And since the best way to publicize things is on Shabbat, so we take the Shabbat of or before Rosh Chodesh Adar. Right, it's easy. Why Zachor? I forgot. Why Zachor? Because we hold, and I'm in the middle of an interesting email dispute with somebody about this, but we hold that Purim is a manifestation of the war against Amalek, even if none of the players were genealogically Amalek, and as a result of that, the victory was a victory over Amalek, and therefore, we established the yearly commemoration of Amalek to be that before Purim. Okay, good. Why HaChodesh? I'll skip Parah. Why HaChodesh? Why is HaChodesh read on or before Shabbat Rosh Chodesh? Because the reading is about getting your lamb ready. So it's like reminding everybody, and it's kind of like Shkalim, giving people enough advance notice to get their stuff ready, so you have two weeks or more than that. This year it's exactly 2 weeks to get your animal ready for the Korban Pesach. Okay. What about Parah? Why is Parah read now? So you could even ask the question, why is Parah read at all? Well, as we have Parshat Chukat, we read it in the summer, we read the laws, why do they have a special reading of Parah Adumah? So there is an opinion, Shachar quotes, Yesh Omrim, that Parashat Parah is Doraita, based on Chukat Olam, etc., but it's not the majority view. And so therefore, and even if it was Doraita, why do it now? By the way, what would be the better time to do it? What? So you could do it the Shabbat before Pesach Sheni, which of course is a season which till our generation was pretty empty of things. That'd be kind of fun. Right? I would do it before Rosh Hashanah, because all the Chagim coming up. But, you know, that's kind of the reason we do Pesach, because after a while we do Pesach time. Because everybody is Chayav and Korban Pesach, and so it's a reminder, if anybody was Tamei Mate, go check out your local Parah Adumah, which is not local, it's one place. Go to the Parah Adumah, get Hazah, etc., become Tahor, so you can do the Korban Pesach. Okay, we get it. I think there may be something much deeper going on in the connection between Parah and Pesach. That is why Parshat Parah is here. And so let's take a look at just a few things in the Parshat. The Parshat is long. And I'm just going to remind you of something that we've all gone through at different times. Some of us may have gone through it even this morning in the office. Is that, you know, sometimes you're in a room with somebody else on the phone. This happens now more frequently because people are on the phone everywhere. Somebody's on the phone in the elevator, or somebody's on the phone walking down the hallway in your office. And you hear an animated conversation, but you, of course, only hear one side. And sometimes if you want to have a little fun, you imagine what's going on the other side. Well, sometimes we have such things in literature where we have one side of a conversation, we hear it very clear, loud and clear, we know that the other side is disagreeing because we hear angry shouts or whatever, and we have no idea what the other side is saying. And that's something that we've had for the past 1,800 years or so. Because in the both Tanaitic literature and the literature of the Gemara, but chiefly in Tanaitic literature, there's quite a number of recorded disputes with the sectarians that revolve around chiefly three areas. One of them is the calendar. That's one of the most prominent one. One of them is the Mikdash, and one of them is about Tumah v'Tahara. Those are the three broad areas, although there's disputes in a lot of other areas, against the sectarians. When I say sectarians, I'm referring to those people who are members of what we call sects, because they're not us, they would call us sectarians, at the end of Bayit Sheni. So let's call it from the year 100 BCE till 70 CE. Afterwards, they're going to drop off the map. And broadly, we would call this group Tzedokim, Sadducees, although there's a lot of different subgroups and all sorts of other chevra involved. Okay. And so in our material, we hear about disputes with them, and sometimes we'll even hear the arguments in favor of our position, but we never hear the other side of the conversation. So as a quick example, the Gemara in several places talks about a law called Nitzok. Nitzok works like this. I have this cup of Dr. Pepper here, this is a can of Dr. Pepper. I'm holding it up in the air. I have here a cup. All right, let's say that this is actually wine, and let's say that this is a clay vessel or a glass vessel. And let's say that this vessel became tameh. Okay, so please watch what I'm doing. I'll try to do it well. Okay, now what's the status of this can now?
Partially filled.
What? What?
It depends if the tumor flows up.
Well, right now, look at that. What's the status? So we would say the can is still tahor, because this is tameh. The drink inside is tameh. That's it. The sectarian said it's actually, as long as there's this, I'm going to run out soon. As long as there's a single flow, then it is tameh, because it connects it. That's a dispute we had with them. And then we have some of the reasoning and the argumentation behind it, and some of the caveats. By the way, if there's something like honey, we agree with them, because it's viscous, right? It's all connected, but not with flowing liquid. And so these disputes are recorded in the Gemara, and sometimes the arguments behind our position. The most famous one, of course, is the argument, and we've talked about this a few times here, is the argument for Shavuot being on any day of the week and not only on Sunday, and the whole Mechorah Shabbat thing. And we have a whole huge literature supporting the idea that Mechorah Shabbat doesn't mean Sunday, or exclusively Sunday. And the Gemara gives 8 reasons, and the Sefer gives another few reasons, and the Rambam gives his, and Rabbi Yudah Levi gives his, and everybody weighs in on it, including till contemporary times, weighs in on why halacha is the correct read of the text, or is the proper tradition, whatever. But we don't know what they say. In other words, all we know is that we disagree with them. We know maybe what their position is. We have no idea what the rationale behind their position is, which, of course, we have no interest in knowing that. So in 1947, of course, the most important archaeological find ever, at least in the realm of biblical archaeology, was discovered, and that's the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's really not biblical archaeology, it's post-biblical archaeology. But the impact on both understanding Tanakh, interpretation of Tanakh, and also the impact on understanding the sects and early Christianity and a whole lot of huge things is immeasurable. And perhaps the most important of all the texts, thousands of texts that were found in that library in 11 different caves, was found in cave 4, and it's marked as 4Q267, I think, and it's also known as 4QMMT. MMT stands for Miktsat Maaseh Torah, and it's like part of a Shulchan Aruch for the cult, for the group. And that includes their calendar, which is very revealing about a lot of things, and it actually sheds light on things that we hear in the Gemara that we don't necessarily understand. And so we now have a little of access to the other side of the conversation. I'm saying that because we're going to look into a conversation that we've only gotten access to the other side recently. We'll explain a lot of things going on. Okay, take a look in front of us. Source 1, we've got the entire Parshat Parah. You still have to hear it on Shabbat, but nonetheless, here it is. And I want to point to several things to you. If you look at Pasuk Tet is really the main thing. Here's what happens. You take a parah. Actually, let's look a little bit earlier, because there's a critical piece to this puzzle. You take a parah duma and all the requirements of what it is. Look at Pasuk Gimel. Unetatem ota el Elazar HaKohen. Who is Elazar? Who is Elazar HaKohen?
Aaron's
Aaron's son, which means whenever the Torah talks about Elazar HaKohen, what it means is this is something that's done either by the Sgan Kohen Gadol, or more likely what it means, it's done by any Kohen. If it says Aharon, then it's done by Kohen Gadol. Okay, so now Elazar Kohen takes midama. You're gonna shecht it, but we're gonna shecht it. Look at Pasuk Gimel. Votziotai al michutz l'machaneh, and that's the piece that one of the pieces here. This entire thing takes place outside of the camp. Okay, and now look at Pasuk Dalugach. Elazar Kohen midama me'etzbo v'izay al nochach pre'o moed midama sheva pe'amim. So you're gonna shecht it outside of the camp. What side of the camp? Will become obvious right now on the east side of the camp. Because he's going to then, from where he shechted, he's going to take the blood, and he's going to sprinkle it in the direction of the opening to the Mishkan. Which, by the way, means this can only be done when the Mishkan is there. Can't be while you're traveling. Okay, that makes sense. You take this cow outside of the camp, slaughter it, facing the doorway, and sprinkle in the direction of the door. Right? Sheva pamim, and then it's all burnt up there outside of the camp. All right, and then in pasuk vav, the kohen takes etz erez ve'zov u'shnitolat, the three different ingredients to go into the fire. U'shlicha toch shofar apa, throws it into the fire, and then v'chibes v'gadav kohen. This kohen has to then go to the mikvah, and his clothes go to the mikvah. Rachav zman v'amayim v'chayiv olam machaneh v'tamei kohen er ha'arev. He's tamei for one for that day. There's a guy who's burning it. He's going to become Tamei. And now, Pasuk Tet. And this is the focal point of this whole dispute. The Asaf Ish Tahor. My kids like to ask who Asaf is. He's an Ish Tahor. The Asaf Ish Tahor means an Ish Tahor will gather. Et Efer HaParah. V'niach Michutz L'machaneh Makom Tahor. He's going to gather the ashes and put it in a Makom Tahor. And it'll be waiting there, and then you're going to put the water in it and do the mix, and that's going to be used for the purification ceremony that comes later on in this parsha. And also the guy who gathered this becomes Tameh. So everybody who's involved with this becomes Tameh, which leads to the very, very famous riddle of the or paradox of the Paraduma. It renders those who are unclean clean, and then it renders anybody involved with it who was clean not clean. Okay, and then the rest of this is the laws of para of tumat mate, and then the ritual involving it. But that the preparation is the part we just read. Good. Okay, that's the law. That's the law. So who is it who's supposed to be doing the stuff? We find out that Elazar, which means a Kohen, but not Kohen Gadol, is going to be the one who has to shecht it and do the thing, do the spritzing of the dam. Who is it who's going to be doing the burning of it and the throwing in of the various things, like the red string and the hyssop and the cedar wood? Who is that? Who is it who's going to be collecting the ashes and putting them together? Who is that?
Doesn't say.
Now in Pasuk Ted it says Ish Tahor, and then after doing it he suddenly is Tamei for the day. Okay, at least to the following thing, which I got to be honest with you, I really always puzzled over this Mishnah. I found very puzzling. Source 2 is the Mishnah in Masachet Parah. Masachet Parah is a Masachet that is not learned mainstream. For the most part, people who study Masachet Parah are people who were at an Avel's house and that was what was left. And they filled it in. Or, what?
Parsha's part of my bar mitzvah.
Yes, but did you study Masachet Parah? Okay, good. Then prove my point. And yet you didn't go to an Avel's house to do Mishnayot.
Because he wrote the speech.
Okay, good. V'zignei Yisrael, watch this. Hayum makdimim baraglehem lahar hamishcha. So the elders would go, this is describing the ceremony, they would go up to Har Mishcha. Mishcha is Har HaZeitim. Mishcha means anointing, oil, olive. U'beit tvila hayasham. There was a mikveh there. U'metamim, get this, hayu et ha-kohen ha-soref et ha-para. The kohen, who would be burning the para, they would make him tameh. beforehand. In other words, they take a dead sheretz and touch him to it to become tamei. Mimnei hatzadokim. Why were they doing it? Because of the Sadducees. Shelo yomrim b'murave shemesh haitan na'aseit. In other words, the Sadducean position was that you have to be fully tahor. What's murav shemesh? It means the sun is set. How do you become tahor? So on whatever your last day of tumah is, you go to the mikvah. If you were tameh, you have other things you have to do, but you have to go to the mikvah on the last day you were of your tumah. And then you wait. And then when the sun sets, you become tahor. If you did not go to the mikvah during the day, the sun setting is not going to help you. You got to go to the mikvah the next day and then wait for the sun to set. Right? It has to be harav shemesh. So everybody goes to the mikvah during the day with their tamei. So if you're tumat yom, which means you touched a dead sheretz or something, a dead nevela, and you became tamei, then you go to the mikvah right away. And for the rest of the day, you are in a status that we call tvul yom. Somebody who's already gone to the mikvah that day, and the sun has not yet set. And the Torah recognized that a tvul yom is lighter tumah, but not fully tahor. The tzedokim said that the kohen who does this has to be somebody who's fully 100% tahor. So what do we do? What do the chachamim do? We actually took a kohen who was going to be doing the burning, and we had him touch a dead sheretz. He's tamei. Then he'd go into the mikvah, and then he would do the burning. In order to make what point? That you don't need to be fully tahor, you can be a tvul yom. So if you think about it, there are two weird things about this. One weird thing is, I understand if the guy who you appointed turned out to be a tvul yom, so you want to allow him. But to go out of your way with his demonstration, here, everybody, look, he's touching a dead rat. He's tamei until tonight. Okay, he's going to the mikvah. He's now at full yom, and now he's going to go burn the para. It's a little weird. But the second thing is, like, for whom are you making the point?
There were no tzedukim back then.
No, there were. Of course there were. This is when there's a Beit HaMikdash.
No, but I'm saying when the Torah is written, you don't have this.
This is not Torah. This is describing what they did in Endabai Cheney times. What? Exactly. So they interpret Ish Tahor means Tahor from this, not Tahor from that. It's a certain Dovendrega. They darshan it. You're right. The simple pshat is like the Tzedukim, right? You're right. The simple read is like the Tzedukim. So we got to figure out now three things. Thing one, why are they going so far out of their way to actually make him Tamei, to make this? Second of all, for whom is it proving the point? The Tzedukim are there, but it doesn't prove a point to them, does it? Because after all, they say, well, you guys are wrong. It doesn't prove anything. Well, you think it's like a Christian saying, we're going to make our daily or weekly thing on Sunday just to prove to the Jews that they're wrong. It doesn't prove anything. Just, you're doing it differently. And the third thing is, how do you reconcile with the Pasuk? Pasuk says, Asaf Ish Tahor. Right? Now, we're not talking about Asaf, we're talking about Asoreif, but the implication is that it's an Ish Tahor, and the Raya is, he now becomes Tamei as a result. Correct! Very good. Well, what's going on? Now, by the way, there's a fascinating little piece here. If you look at source 3, also Masechet Parah, in the same perek, describes the preparation, the burning thing. Nivka'a v'yamar chutz migita, natal eitz eretz ve'zo v'shnitolat. So the kohen would stand there and take all of these things that are going to go into the fire. Now normally, what would you do? Say, okay, the recipe calls for dead cow, fire, and red string, and cedar wood, and moss, and I understand it. No, there's a beautiful sforno, but I don't get it. But I'm supposed to do it, so I do it, right? Amar Lahen, the guy who's doing it, would turn to the Zekinim who are there and say, Eitz Erez Zeh, Eitz Erez Zeh, this piece of cedar wood, Ezov Zeh, Ezov Zeh, this moss, Shanitolad Zeh, Shanitolad Zeh, this red string, Gimel Pamim HaKol Davar, he'd say three times. And for each one, they'd say yes. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, the moon.
What?
The moon.
Not the moon, but something else on the calendar. Take a look at source 4. I'll just recap it for you. Source 4 describes the cutting of the omer. And it's the exact same thing. The guy comes out there and says, this scythe, yes. This scythe, yes. This scythe, yes. This basket, yes. This basket, this grain, yes. This grain, yes. And if it's Friday night, this Shabbat, yes. This Shabbat, yes. Right? Now, at the end of the Mishnah, why? What's the reason? Look at the bottom line. Mipnei ha-baitusim, which is a subset of the tzedokim, beit sin, shahayu omrim ein tzirat ha-omer motzei yom tov. Because their position was, you don't cut the omer the night after Pesach. You cut the omer always on a Saturday night. It's actually after Pesach's over. Right? That was their position. So we're opposing them. How are we opposing them? By making a big deal. What's the big deal? Pomp and circumstance. And a whole ritual. Should I use this scythe? Yes. This scythe? Yes. This scythe? Yes. That grain? Yes. That grain. Big deal in order to oppose their position. So by the way, what you see from the two, and these are the only two Mishnayot like this, where the person doing the act keeps checking with the Beit Din, and there's a three times he asks simple questions about material. I use this, I use this, I use this. Every time I say yes, yes, yes. And it's clearly not for informational purposes, because, I mean, you know what it is, and you only need three times. It's clearly to make a big deal. So the comparison between source 3 and source 4 tells us that source 3 is driven by the same considerations as source 4. Now you can imagine that when they're shechting the Parah Aduma and then burning and everything, there's probably a big crowd there. Just like for the Omer. That's a big deal. So everybody comes around, hey, there's a Parah Aduma around. I haven't had one since my grandpappy's days. Right? We get together and, you know, everybody's taking pictures and selfies of the cow and all that. Right? And they're doing all this stuff. You can imagine it's a huge deal. And the Chachamim here are making it bigger with all of this back and forth. So there's something going on about the Parah Aduma, kind of similar to the Tzirat HaOmer, that has something to do with the polemic against the Tzadokim. Turn the page. You see that there's a machloket in Source 5 about to what extent. Let's start with this. We're reading this week, we read last week about the laver, the kior, the basin. What's the basin used for?
The water.
For the Kohanim to wash. What happens if a Kohen does Avodah without washing? It's Chayav Mita. It's serious. The Avodah is Pasul. The Kohen comes in and didn't do the ritual washing, and it does Kabbalat Adam. Adam is Pasul. Can't use it for Korban. Right? It's a Mishnah in Zvachim. Begin in second parak. Pretty serious. Please take a look at Mishnah 5, at Source 5, which is a Mishnah in Parak Dalet of Masachet Parah. At the second line, V'shelo rachutz yadayim v'raglayim psula. If a Kohen who didn't do rachitzat yadayim v'raglayim does the Kohen, the Paraduma thing, it's pasul. Rabbi Elazar machshir. He says, no, it's kasher. V'shelo b'kohen gadol psula. Rabbi Yehuda machshir. He thinks you need a Kohen gadol. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, you don't. Umechusar b'gadim, how about that? A Kohen who doesn't have all of the big day kuna on. Which, by the way, if you do avodah in the mikdash without it, it's pasul. What do you have here? Psula umchle lavan ata naseit. So it had to be done with clay lavan, which are the same clothes that are used for the Yom Kippur, those four. But notice that we have a machloket going on in the generation after the destruction. Machloket going on, Rabbi Elazar and Rosh Hashanah weighing in on whether or not this has to be done with Rechitzat Yadayim Raglayim, which kind of Kohen. There's stuff going on here about this. And then there's this wild, I'll just remind you, because we've talked about this before, wild Mishnayot, I mean to us wild Mishnayot, about how they would do the preparation for the Parah Aduma years earlier, describing women who would go into these underground caves when they're pregnant and give birth, and the kids would never leave these caves, so they would never come into any possible contact of Tumah, and they'd be the one who would draw the water for the Parah Aduma. Take a look at it here. Now I'll read it. It's fascinating. Chatzerot ha'yub Yerushalayim b'nuyot agabei ha'sela. Tachteim chalum nekevra tahom. They weren't underground, but there were chatzerot, courtyards, that were built over a huge empty cave, so there was no possibility it was a grave within Tumah distance. Alright, Uvim Nashim Ubarod Vyoldot Sham. They bring pregnant women and they give birth there. Now, not necessarily Kohanim. Umagadot Sham et Pnehem. They'd raise their kids in that Chatzer. They wouldn't leave. Umavim Shvarim. They would bring cows, oxen. Vyal Gavehen Daltot. They would have on the on the ox, on the back, they have like a big board. Alright? V'tinokot yoshvin al gabeyan u'kosot shel evan biyadam. And the kids would be sitting on this. So this is the board. They're sitting on the board on top of the ox, and they would be holding stoneware. Stoneware can't become tamei. Alright? Higil the shiloach. They'd go all the way down to the shiloach. The shiloach is, of course, the brechat ha-shiloach, the Yerushalayim spring. Yardu umalum. They would come, go down, fill them up, v'alu v'yashu al-gabayan. Alright? Rabbi Yossi says even more. They would just lower it from their spot. What was the whole point of this whole thing? To erase any faint possibility of tumah. That's what we think. I mean, it sounds extreme. We don't know if it's describing an idyll or what actually happened, but it's the impression is that we went bent over backwards in order to make sure that this thing was not connected to tumah at all. Not so simple. Not so simple. I've mentioned to you MMT. Right? Here I have an English translation, because you have to realize that most of the scrolls are fragments. And part of the study, part of the reason it's taken so long to bring the scrolls to light is because you take fragments and then you have to try to piece together what the missing letter is. Sometimes it's not so clear. Sometimes you have to guess. Sometimes you have to raise two possibilities and try to piece together what the text is. So what you're looking at is an approximation of a section of MMT. And this is talking about Parah Adumah. They have their own Shulchan Aruch about it, right? And notice what it says. And I italicized two key lines. Only a priest who is pure shall sprinkle. And now, by the way, what's our position? It could be a Tful Yom. But here's the real interesting thing that we don't talk about, which is, and a child shall not sprinkle upon the impure. They make it very clear. Who's going to be involved in this process?
Why would a child, who would think a child would even be?
We just had that in the Mishnah. Right? So, who are they demanding do this?
Priests.
Adult, male, Kohanim, who are totally pure. What have we opened up? We've opened up kids being involved in this. We've opened up a Tful Yom being involved with this.
Why would they bring up kids?
Because you see here that we actually are doing that. I'll tell you why. This actually touches on a much bigger point, and I promised you a connection to Pesach. So please take a look at source 7. If you think about the Mikdash, who's in the Mikdash? So in the Mikdash, in the building itself, was only Kohanim. Who's in the Azara? Who's in the courtyard? I think the Kohanim. La Kohanim. They're in the courtyard. And yet, how does Korban Pesach work? So one might suggest that a group of people get together and each group makes sure they have one Kohen in the group. You could suggest that. You could suggest something else. Each group gets together, gets their Korban Pesach, they bring it, and they send it inside with a Kohen. The Kohen does all the Avodah, brings it outside, and they take it home and roast it in Yerushalayim. Look at this, and as we're so used to it, we don't realize how revolutionary it is. Please take a look at the two Mishnayot in Source 7 from Psachim. HaPesach nishchat b'shalosh kitot. Right? There's three groups, there's three shifts. And they bring a pasuk for it. And basically what it says here is, they come in, they fill the Azara. Who are these people? Non-Kohanim. They fill the Azara. They close the doors of the Azara. And what do? They stand in line. And they send the lamb up. And they shech the lamb. They send the blood up. Who shechs the lamb? I do. I'm not a Kohen. I shech the lamb. And I send the dam up. And the dam gets to the Kohanim, set like a bucket brigade. They put on the Mizbeach. And then it's been done. And then, we move from there. I'm not a Kohen. And I'm participating in it. Take a look at Mishnah Vav. Shachat Yisrael v'kivel ha-Kohen. What would happen? I shecht it. And then I hand the blood to the Kohen. And I hand to the Kohen. The Kohen does the Kabbalat Adam. It goes from there on. And it's halacha psuka. Shechita b'zar k'shera. A non-Kohen can do shechita v'korban. What's going on here? So there are those who made a suggestion. I think it's a very appealing suggestion, because I think it works very well with these Mishnayot. and explains the core question that I asked about the two Mishnayot, the one about the Omer and the one about the Parah. What point are you proving here by saying we're doing it our way? All that means is we're doing it our way and we won because we're in control. And when you're in control, you'll do it your way and we'll be upset. It doesn't prove anything. But there's something else going on. There's really a subtle battle going on over the propriety of the Kohanim and the Mikdash. And a piece of that puzzle comes down to a question of what's the Parah Aduma? What's their position? Parah Aduma is a Korban. Therefore, you have to be Tahor, you have to wash your hands, it must be done by an adult Kohen. It's a total Korban, even though it's done outside of the camp. What's our position? It's not outside of the camp, it can't be a regular Korban. And therefore, we're going to open the doors and allow other people to be involved. Whether the other people are kids who are going to be involved on one level, non-Kohanim who are going to be involved on another level, or Kohanim or Tful Yom on another level. And if you think about it, these are the seeds to the success of the most important enterprise that the rabbis were ever involved with. I'm going to make a claim here, but I think you'll agree. The most important enterprise the rabbis were ever involved with was finding a way to transition from temple-based religion to non-temple-based religion. And Haraya, all the other sects, disappeared because they didn't have a way to do it.
Hey, wait a minute. The time frame here...
This is the end of the Second Temple, right here.
The end. The Second Temple's already been destroyed.
No, this is the last
so they're
era.
Anticipating... What I don't think they're if or what.
I'm not saying that they're anticipating. I think that what the rabbis have been engaged with ever since the beginning of the rabbinic period, which is let's say 100 years before the destruction, is in slowly creating a system whereby, and this happens begadol in Yavne and the generation,
temple.
Not what you don't need. That's not an accurate way to say it. Where there can be a religious life that will exist outside of it and without it. And that transition was the single most important enterprise they're involved with because it's why we're here today and why all the other sects disappeared.
So what do you think happened here?
What happened here is, here we are at the end of Beit Sheni. We're not talking about stuff that happened in the Persian period. We're talking in the Greek period. We're talking about stuff in the last 100 years of the Beit, or less. And what's happening, there's a tussle going on. So one of the components of the tussle is the calendar. Right? And that has its own piece to it. But the calendar, if you think about it, becomes separated from the Mikdash. And in their world, it's totally tied into it. Second of all, is the Parah. Is the Parah Duma now becomes a ritual which is done outside of the Mikdash. It can continue to be done without a Mikdash, and was, evidently. And it can be done with people who are not fitting the Mikdash model. It's separated from it. So from these two little Mishnayot, suddenly, possibly, and I'm just suggesting possibly, a much larger worldview dispute comes out, one of which ultimately fails because they disappear, and one of which, of course, succeeds because we are here. And that the issue really comes down to the opening up of the Mikdash to, shall we say, to people who are not normally the officiants, and the opening up of ritual outside of the Mikdash as ritual. And suddenly, Kohanim, non-Kohanim, Tful Yom, Tahor, children, something. I say now there's an open room for involvement, which then springs everything forward. Another possible reason why we read Parah just before Pesach, because Pesach is all about absolute inclusion and involvement of everybody.